Thank you for attending session 363, Evolutionary Thinking and Why We Are Prone to Believing and Having a Hard Time Leaving a Religion. Before we begin, we ask that cell phones are turned off and that those attending will be respectful and attentive. It is the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue. Please keep in mind that when engaging in the Q&A portion of this session, following the remarks of the presenters, those who cannot abide by those guidelines should refrain from commenting and will be asked to leave should they become disruptive. This session is being recorded and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. If you haven't already, see, I'm trying to follow the rules, but my phone's not working. If you haven't already, please consider subscribing to Sunstone Magazine at the registration desk as well. Your support goes directly to keeping symposiums and 40 years of thoughtful dialogue alive and sustainable. Don't forget to check out the bookstore in the ballroom hosted by Benchmark Books. Consider purchasing a book or two to support Mormon Studies and Scholars. This is a 60-minute session, and we ask that both the audience and presenters keep within the framework of time so we can allow for the next session to start on time. I'm going to leave the intro to Dr. Carson Calderwood, who is a dentist and an undergraduate in evolutionary biology.
Thank you. All right, I think I'm going to stand just because I'm a lot more calm if I can move around and wiggle a lot. So I'll give my disclaimer in a little bit. I'm going to disclaimer first. I'll give my intro in a little bit as part of the presentation. But at the end, again, if you can, write down questions if you want as they come up to you. At the end, if we haven't, try to make sure we have time to do them. If you don't answer, I'm going to have my email and a link to where you can actually get the long form narrative of this, and you can send me questions if you want later on, or just grab me later on. So don't worry if we can't get to them. The problem I have is I honestly always have 3 hours, and I did my first practice and it was like almost an hour and a half, and my cut out a bunch in my second one and it was an hour, so I'm gonna have a really hard time trying to fit this in. So I'll go fast. It will be a little eclectic, but hopefully you get the conclusion from all of it. So basically, the purpose I have here is how emotions and thought processes are a natural result of our evolution and not direct communication from God. These are the points I'm going to try and show today. These emotions and thought processes make us prone to believing in a religion, and they also make it hard for us to walk away from a religion. So those are the three things I'm going to try and prove today. So like I said, write down any questions if you have. So my background. I was one of those Mormon kids who was fully committed, come from a long line of Mormons. To give you a quick example, in high school, I did my own family history research, took the names to the temple. I was writing my journal every night, reading my scriptures 30 hours a day, did a family home evening to tell my parents we got to stop watching rated R movies, and so I was that annoying kid. And all that came from because I never got a witness that the church was true, and I thought it was because I wasn't trying hard enough, I wasn't worthy enough, and so I was just motivated more and more to try and do what I had to do to get it. Kind of a scrupulosity a little bit is what I kind of feel like I developed a little bit over trying to make this work. I would hear something, and that if you pray, you'll get the witness, and it didn't happen. So basically, this is my culmination of 30 years of research, why I didn't, personal research, why that didn't work out for me, and what answers actually did work. My scientific background, I'm not a scientist, but I am a dentist, and I don't hunt lions, in case you're wondering about that. I love evolution, I love biology. My senior thesis in my undergrad, it was on zoology, which is kind of like evolutionary biology is a better way to describe it. It was on evolution, and it was a capstone class, so I loved that and spent a lot of time researching that. And basically, this is just the convergence of these two backgrounds. So, what is evolution? You probably all know about that. It's basically, just real quick, that we have random mutations in our genes that over time, certain mutations will be better adapted to a certain niche in the environment, and those, if you have those advantages, it's more likely your genes will be passed on, and then they're selected for over time, and that helps create the diversity we have in the world. It's the great unifying law of biology. It brings everything together. It's indisputable. And it's too complex to really get into, but basically, it's how we evolved as a communal species. And we evolved, and this is what I'll go into a lot today. We have a lot of things in us, and that make us want to be part of a tribe, that make it so that we're scared to leave a tribe, that we want to, we receive a lot of joy from being part of a tribe. And that's kind of what I'll explain, and all that comes out through evolution. So what are emotions? Emotions, the best way to describe it, short and sweet, is they are neural impulses that move an organism to action. I'll give a couple examples here. Basically, there's a bunch of examples of different types of emotion, but think of two species. Think of species A that is feels happy when it eats carbohydrates or fat. Species B that doesn't feel different no matter what it eats. Species A feels disgust if it sees rotting food. Species B doesn't have that emotion. Species A is obviously a lot more likely to eat the fat and carbohydrates and have more energy and survive, a lot less likely to eat the rotten food and get diseases, more likely to survive, where species B doesn't care, just eats whatever. And that's why how we evolved, to have the emotions that we'll have when we see rotting food that can create some disgust in us, or when we see a cupcake, we can get excited about it. I'll give you a quick example. How does that make you guys feel? See that? It's a little freaky. There's actually been studies done where they'll show different objects to kids, little infants, and if it has the four legs on each side, it'll make it have unpleasant feelings. This is instinctive in us. We see something with four legs on each side, it bugs us. We see something with three legs, this isn't a great picture, it doesn't create that visceral response in us as much, and that's how we evolved to have those. So I'm going to go through five aspects of each emotion to help describe these. I'm going to description of the emotion, what it is, how it likely evolved in humans, examples of this in non-Mormons today, examples in Mormonism, and finally the problem with the Mormon position as I contrast those. So that's how I'm going to break down each one of these. I'm going to start off with the elevation response. Has anyone heard of this out of curiosity? Cool. Awesome. Some people. Jonathan Haidt, who's like one of my heroes. If I'm actually going to try and get to come to Sunstone, I think I'll form a coup and get him to come here. I think that would be amazing. He's done a lot of study research on this, and the elevation response is basically the positive emotional response you get when you see an act of social virtue. It's kind of one of the ways he describes. Seeing acts of compassion. You see that, and it makes you feel some good feelings. So, I'm going to try and show you guys a video real quick. Let's see if we can get this to work here. The audio doesn't matter too much. Let me switch screens, sorry. So it has the text. Can you guys kind of see that at the bottom there? All right. I'll try and get the audio to play through the microphone here. How do you guys feel after watching that? Anybody feeling the spirit?
Yeah.
It's pretty powerful, right? It's, that's the elevation effect. And it's a pretty powerful emotion. Every time I watch that when I was at home multiple times, it would bring tears to my eyes. Is that because those people are Mormon? Or is it because they're Christian? They're obviously not. It's what we felt was that elevation effect. And I forgot to say my disclaimer a bit. I'm actually probably going to offend a lot of people with this because it's going to... I come from a very agnostic background right now, and so I'm going to explain all this through a purely scientific background and not from a religious viewpoint. But I'll kind of come full circle to that at the end. So that... growing up and feeling like seeing stuff like that, you know, basically, is that the one true video of the internet? No, that's kind of the narrative that I got. If you feel those feelings, it's because God is telling you that this is true, and that if you read the Book of Mormon and feel that, it's because it's the one true book. And that created a lot of conflict in myself. I would feel those feelings when I would see, described to me as the Spirit, when I'd see other people doing good things. I'd get down and pray, and I wouldn't feel anything praying about the Book of Mormon, praying about the church. There was even a couple of times where I'd read about Enos praying all day, and I set a timer, and I actually prayed for an hour. I did that twice in my life. Literally made myself stand on my knees and pray for an hour. I'm like, maybe if I do that, I'll get that witness. And it still didn't happen. So, sorry, I got the wrong slide here. Get back on track. All right, that's not working off the speed through. So, examples of this in non-Mormons today. You watch the show Extreme Home Makeover. They pull the truck away. Like, always brings you to tears. You see all this good stuff happening for this family in need. It just makes you tear up, makes you feel this emotion, makes you feel these feelings of the Spirit. And so we see it all around us and today. Examples of it in Mormonism. We're told this is the Spirit confirming, like I said, that what we're seeing from God. The problem with this is that we can feel these from when we have works of fiction. That wasn't a true life experience. That was a video that someone made to give across the idea of giving is good, to encourage other people to give. You watch that, it makes you feel those feelings. So we can't use those feelings as a tool to discern truth. We could potentially use that to discern goodness, but not necessarily truth. Sorry, I'll skip through the spider quickly here so I don't cause too much stress. I don't have to leave again, so that shouldn't get out of whack there. Okay. My history on this is I watched the movie Independence Day in high school. And you guys remember that with Will Smith? The whole world came together to fight the aliens, and I had one of the most profound spiritual experiences in my life when the whole world came together, and I was like, so felt, you know, I was all emotional watching this movie about aliens, and it kind of tripped me out. And that's what went, that kind of set me on this path of wondering, you know, why am I feeling these different emotions? All right, almost caught up. All right, fruits of the Spirit, that's what we're feeling. Okay, other people feel these feelings. There's a video I was going to show, but we don't have time, where it goes through and shows people bearing their testimonies of why their church is true. And none of them are Mormons, but they're using all the words we're familiar with, that I know God told me that I felt this burning in my bosom. So I'm Muslim saying I felt burning in my bosom, and I know every fiber of my being. And you're like, what? That's so Mormon. But it's a guy with his whatever hat. They call that a Muslim guy. Bearing the truth, his testimony about Muslim religion. And that caused a lot of irritation in me, having that tension. So there was a study done called the Most Correct Religion Survey, where they interviewed people who said that their religion was one where God will tell you if your church is true. So of those people they surveyed, 82% said they had received an answer. God had told them that their church was true. 73% said that not only did they receive that answer, but it was a very sure answer. They were very sure that God told them it was true. There's 22 different religions participated in that, and none of them were Mormon. So the point of all this is a very universal thing. It happens in all these other religions. They're experiencing the same things as we do. And I think growing up in the bubble that I grew in, it created a lot of, I thought we were the only ones, and I didn't have that insight to know that other people are doing the same thing. So the next emotion is gratitude. Gratitude is the feeling you feel when you're the recipient of that good deed that makes you feel the elevation effect. So, positive emotion. There was a study done on some sorority girls where they gave them different acts of kindness between the sorority girls. And the stronger they had a greater response of gratitude when they felt like the person was more caring in the gift that they gave. So the more you feel, the more someone cares about you and does something for you, the more gratitude you're going to feel. Why did we evolve to have that? To be that communal species, you might want to be selfish and go and hoard all of the food for yourself. But if you go and give it to someone who's in need, instead of being selfish, you're kind of hurting yourself a little bit. But by giving that to the other person, having the good feelings that come from that, making you want to do it, they'll reciprocate. We're all helping each other, and it builds this synergistic effect that us as a tribe are a lot stronger than the dudes that are out there doing it on their own. So that synergy is what gave us an evolutionary advantage and made us more of a tribal species. So we're all very familiar with this. We feel gratitude. You know, we see that all the time, so I'm actually going to skip that. Mormonism tells us this is a part to becoming a community of Zion, that we do these things to help come together as one people. We feel these good feelings as we come together as one. The problem with the Mormon position on this is that it's felt the exact same feelings and emotions by non-Mormons when they're in their tribe, when they're in their community, in their church, and they're doing good things. They're all experiencing, again, the same things despite that. The gift of the Holy Ghost problem is now that I've been excommunicated and no longer have the gift of the Holy Ghost, I shouldn't be feeling these feelings as much as I used to before. But I actually feel more, ironically, because I kind of let go of some of those tensions, and I just try and be good to good people for goodness sake. And I actually feel a lot of happiness, more happiness in my life. Converts, I've talked to converts who converted, who was really looking forward to that gift of the Holy Ghost, and they felt like there was no difference in the feelings, the frequency, the quantity, or quality of the feelings they were feeling before their gift and after. So I'm going to move on now to subconscious intuition. This is a little complicated. I'm talking about kind of the brain. So we have our subconscious, and we have our consciousness. And the other people I'm going to offend, since Chelsea walked in and reminded me of this, besides the members, are the scientists, because I'm going to not explain this 100% accurately. And there's differing views, too. I'm going to pick the views to kind of work with what I've got here. So basically, the way I like to think of it is you have all these subconscious processes going around. You're noticing. My subconscious is seeing all of you in the room. It's seeing the wall. It's noticing the light. It's noticing the cobwebs in the corner. It's noticing all these things, but it's passing up to my frontal cortex, the important things. What's the facial expression on my wife? Is she liking this or not? Am I doing a good job? Has it been 15 minutes? All those things my consciousness is aware of. That you guys are people, these are you're in chairs. All that tangible stuff. Those are conscious ideas. We'll have subconscious gut feelings. So I'm going to break this up and do two things that describe both these intuition decision makings that we have, and how the Mormon Church says that is from the Spirit. So, basically, this is from a really old part in our brains, the emotions that are involved in this. You know, if you poke a lizard with a stick that hurts, it's going to try and run away. We have things that have been around for a long time, and our subconscious is a really old part of our brain. Our forebrain, you know, our consciousness is more where we make decisions. What separates us a little more from some of the animals is a more modern evolution on that. So, I'm going to call a conscious idea an epiphany, where your subconscious may be working on things and it puts together some connections, and all of a sudden you have an aha moment. That's an epiphany you might have. If your subconscious is working on things and you don't really necessarily have a fully conscious idea, but you feel something emotionally and emotions, I'm going to call that your gut feeling, and we're going to talk about that. So, as a dentist, this comes up a lot. I have people come in freaked out all the time. This isn't a good picture, but like say some guy, I have this guy, literally happened, he, 40-year-old man, really successful financially, super amazing guy, and he was freaking out for a cleaning. He's like, I know you're not gonna hurt me, and he's all shaking, and he's like tearing up, and he's like, I just had a tooth taken out when I was a little kid, and the dentist didn't numb me up, and he said I was, told me to shut up, and he pulled it out, and I have always been afraid of the dentist ever since. That's locked into his, you know, his limbic system. That's his fear center. He's going to have that happen always. He'll have that. He can't get over that. That gut feeling fear is always going to be there. Sometimes that gut feeling can come from past experiences. Sometimes it can come from our subconscious noticing things. If we walk in, we're not fully aware of the cobwebs in the corner, we might feel a little bit of a scary feeling because we know spiders are going to be in there. And even though we're not thinking there's spiders in here, we'll have an uneasy feeling. So that's kind of how science will explain those. Examples of it in Mormonism, if a lot of times you're told it's the good versus evil spirit. If you're feeling a bad feeling when you walk into a room, it might be your subconscious noting the spider webs in the corner. The church will tell you that maybe the spirit isn't there, and you're feeling a lack of the spirit, and that's where that negative feeling is coming from. It's not coming from your brain or your body, it's coming from the spirit outside. conscious idea. If you have an epiphany all of a sudden, you put two and two together. It's the spirit telling you that, giving you, whispering to your mind. And if, actually I'll get into the second, the problems with it. That gut feeling is being guided by the spirit. If you're having a gut feeling that you need to do something, you really feel like you need to go over there and do that, you need to knock on that door. That's the spirit telling you that you need to go knock on that door instead of maybe something that house looks, you see kids in the window and you see they're more of a family and more likely to accept the message. So problems with this position is how can you tell the difference between your spirit and your brain? That's a problem I struggled with forever. Am I having this idea? Do I need to go back and shut the oven off because that idea just popped in my mind? Or did I leave the oven on and the spirit's telling me so my house doesn't burn down? It's so hard. I could never differentiate between the two. And I thought it was me, it was broken, that I was a poor spiritual understander however you want to call that. I just couldn't, it didn't work for me. And I felt like a bad person for that. Like I wasn't trying hard again. I'm not referring here to actually really strong and powerful spiritual experiences like vision stuff. I'm actually going to talk about that later. I'm talking more about those feelings and impressions you get. Similar to the elevation effect, everyone is experiencing these gut feelings, these promptings, impressions in all our religions. And maybe it's God helping all of us, or maybe it's from our body, but it definitely isn't, in my experience, any special gift that we have from being in this church. Confirmation bias, I'm going to talk about that a little later as well. So, let's go back to the person who got the traumatic experience as a kid where the tooth got pulled out. They have a cleaning today. They need to go get their cleaning, but they have this bad gut feeling. Is the spirit telling them they shouldn't go because there's a piano that's going to drop on them on their way and crush them and they're going to die? Or is it just the emotional response of the fear? Happening? Which is it? Is it God's warning sign? So they don't go. They decide something bad is going to happen. I feel something bad. They don't go. They miss finding out about that cavity they had on their x-ray, and then turns into root canal. So instead of getting the cleaning, now they need the cleaning and the root canal and the crown, and they have all the pain associated with that. So sometimes if we go with our gut feelings, it's not a good thing. Sometimes it can be. So just go to your dentist and it'll all work out well in the end. Alright, so unique and powerful spiritual experiences. How am I doing on time, by the way?
7 after. So,
40
minutes. You have a half an hour at least.
Okay, awesome. We're going well. So, this is part that's really fascinating to me about really powerful experiences, spiritual experiences. Because I'd have the little spiritual experiences when I see good things happen, but I would never have anything powerful. I had a buddy in his mission. He talked about one time during a discussion, he felt like his spirit came out of his body and he looked down and could see the discussion happening. And it happened when everyone was feeling the spirit really powerfully. I was so jealous of that experience. I'm like, why can't I have that? I'm trying so hard. My mission, I decided I'm going to be the best missionary. It's hard not to cuss there. I'm going to be the best missionary ever. I'm going to work so hard. I'm going to never sleep in a minute. I'm going to actually stay up late even though I'm going to try extra hard. And when I go, and I serve in Argentina, when you go home, they let you go through the temple on your way home from the mission. And I'm like, when I put my sacrifice on the altar, if I don't get that experience before, that's when it will happen. I know it will. And when I went through, not only did I not have feel the spirit in the temple there, I felt a very awkward, weird feeling. And that's when I became basically agnostic. I decided if I haven't had that experience now, it's not going to happen. And not only did I lose my testimony in the church, I lost my testimony in God at that point. I like to say I'm agnostic. I don't like to say atheist because it could be out there. We don't know everything. Maybe there is. I'm hopeful agnostic. That's what I like to say. But I never had any of those experiences, and that's what led me to this wondering about all this. So there's this chemical called DMT. It's found naturally in humans. We produce it in our brain. It's found in many animals. It's found in plants. It's just all throughout the plant and animal kingdom. There's a physician, let me get his name here. Dr. Rist Strassman, he wrote a book on it. He gave 400 doses to 60 volunteers and had them document the experiences they had. It's hallucinogenic. It's like psilocybin, LSD, mescaline, where it makes you have these experiences, which is a funny story. I am in MTC, some guy, I don't remember who he was, he gave a talk and he's like, if you've had drugs before, that's a counterfeit spiritual experience. And I pounded the pulpit. He said really like intense. And I was like, holy cow, so I've never had a spiritual experience, but I can maybe have a counterfeit one. Like, that really struck a chord with me strong. And so I have more stories about that I can share later. But it's this, keeping that in mind, as I read about this book about DMT experiences, as he would inject this drug into people, they would have experiences. I'm going to list them up here, and we'll go and kind of go through them. It'll be kind of small to get them all in there. People would have experiences where they feel separation of mind from the body, like my friend on his mission, what he felt. They'd feel a sense of wonder or awe, an undeniable certainty of the experience, where they would use the phrase, it was more real than real. That's what a lot of the participants experienced. The setting that they set it up in, they first were in a loud, noisy part of the hospital, and people wouldn't have as strong of experiences, so they got to a quiet experience, and they had to meditate and think ahead of time. It created a stronger experience, DMT experience for them. They'd have insights that would come together and pull, network their brain better, and they'd have new insights into their life and stuff like that. They'd be tearful a lot, lots of increased emotion. It's enhanced with music, meditation, prayer, fasting, isolation ritual, all enhance that DMT experience. They would feel extraordinary joy, a sense of timelessness, like being eternal, like more real than real was big. It's naturally released during our sleep cycles, and if you ever have that when you wake up from a dream, you're like, holy cow, like I thought, like I really thought my wife left me, you know, some dream, and you're freaked out because you really thought it was real. That is an effect of the DMT a little bit that's released during our sleep cycle. We'll have blinding white lights experiences, encounter with demonic and angelic entities, sensations of being lifted up physically, tree of life visions. Lots of them reported that, and none of them were Mormon in the study. That's fascinating to me. They would remember the experience clearly, powerfully for years, and it would last with them. And actually, last night, Dr. Ferguson talked about a little bit how for 6+ months, people would think back on the experience and they'd feel happy about it, and it would make them positive. Make them feel really good having had that experience. So, conclusions about this. Considering that list of DMT effects and how they parallel spiritual experiences that we hear about in the Mormon experience, we have to ask ourselves, are these spiritual experiences from God or from the brain and chemicals? And some people feel the DMT experience more when they get injected the same dosage, they would respond differently. And my kind of theory, the conclusion I came to is, I just don't produce it much. Like if my wife and I both had various surgeries on my leg and stuff, and if I take narcotics like Vicodin, Percocet, I feel super happy. I love everybody, and I just want to go hug everybody. She gets sick to her stomach and nauseous. Just the same drug, same amount, totally different effect. So my conclusion is that people like me who never had the spiritual experience, I either don't produce as much of the DMT in my brain, it doesn't affect me the same, and then others that do, they maybe just produce more and affects them more, and that's why they can have those powerful spiritual experiences and people like me don't. So the point being, if you beat yourself up for decades and years like I did about not being broke, about being broken, not being good enough, trying hard enough, it's not even bad. And that was what's hard, why I could finally come to the conclusion, if you know our background a little bit, about 2 years ago I finally said I don't think the church is true, despite almost 20 years of thinking that way. It was so hard to get to the point where I could feel like I was right, my family, my friends, the 12 apostles, all these people I respect were wrong. And I just didn't have the confidence to make that decision until I had research and research and research, and everything pointed to this is the fact for me. And that's how I was able to come to the conclusion, how I was able to step away. Because it's hard to have that effect when you have people talking about having these spiritual experiences and confirming it. There are testimonies to you of these amazing experiences that prove that the church is true. All right, and just real quick, I think that those who were more likely to have those type of experiences responded, got pulled into the religion as time has gone on, like an evolutionary effect, basically. They're more likely to be in the evolution, have the kids that have that as well, and pass it on. And there are a lot more chemicals in our bodies than just DMT that make us feel this. One thing I forgot to say earlier, actually, a little teaser, I'll let that sit there. Is that we have, we can induce a lot of these emotions in people. We can give someone an oxytocin spray and make them feel more loving in connection to the person that they're with, no matter who they are. If they're a stranger, they'll just feel the love. We can do electric probes into the brain to make people feel these, again, where they can use some magnetic resonance, that's not a term, but you can, Yeah, you can externally stimulate these emotions in people, showing that side. So this is a little trippy, pardon the pun, on this next part I'm going to go into about Joseph Smith parallels to the DMT that I was just talking about. So a lot of people have asked themselves, why did all those, so many amazing, like kind of crazy, but so many amazing, powerful spiritual experiences that so many people had, why did they stop when he died? And what was so magic about Joseph Smith that made that happen? Was he just so close to God that being around him helped others have those spiritual experiences? And I was talking with someone else recently that that was the last straw they let go of to let go of the churches, and they never had an answer for it, but what kept them in is reading these early accounts of so many people having, like in the Kirtland Temple, everyone seeing angels. He's like, if multiple people, 20, whatever it was, 30 plus people were saying they saw angels there all together, that's a testimony of, you know, 1, 2, 3, like we talk about in church, of several people, and that was hard for him to let go of. So there are some really bizarre firsthand accounts that we don't hear in the church, because the church is obviously going to give us the filtered best version. Let me read one of these to you guys. So according to John Whitmer, who was the official church historian in Joseph Smith's time, some converts to the new religion, when they'd have these meetings, would act like an Indian in the act of scalping, or would slide or scoot on the floor with the rapidity of a serpent. During the ordination of ceremony of Harvey Whitlock as a high priest in 1831, this is that African-American guy, he was have seemed to have turned, sorry, a white guy, sorry, I got it backwards, turned as black as Lyman was white. His fingers were set like claws, and unable to speak, he went around the room with eyes the shape of ovals. On another occasion, one man who weighed over 200 pounds was thrown into the air by an unseen force. Another one began screaming like a panther and jumping around the room looking like a panther. So, you know, there's a lot of those stories that have, in the long version of this, which I'll have a link to at the end. There's other stories, like crazy, crazy stories that to us sound really bizarre in our modern world. Maybe it was Satan pulling off some crazy stuff and making this guy look like a panther and jump around the room, and this other guy changes his skin color instantly and all these weird things. That sounds a little too bizarre for me, and it didn't make sense. So luckily, as I was doing research back in 2007 in Sunstone, a guy gave a presentation on, he did tons of research about all of the potential hallucinogenic connections with Joseph Smith. And I'm going to give you a quick little summary of that. So hallucinogenics both grow in the Sacred Grove today and did back then, and on the Hill Cumorah. The mushrooms that grow on the Hill Cumorah are harvested in the fall, the exact same time of year the Joes had to go back every year to see Moroni. When you dry them out, they turn into these little gold, thin, plate-like things, kind of crazy. And when you dry them out, they have these little markings that look like reformed Egyptian, whatever that looks like, from what we're seeing. So the second-hand accounts of that. So it's kind of crazy. It's a little like, I'm incredulous. I don't like to be a conspiracy theorist, but when I read this guy's Sunstone presentation, actually later on got turned into a dialogue article, so in the sources you can go and look that up and read it if you want. It's pretty amazing. There is a lot of connections, and when you make an extract from those hallucinogenics, it makes a red tincture that then can be put into red wine. As many of you know, a lot of the really profound spiritual experiences that many people had happened after they had sacramental red wine, or laying on hands with oil they put on their head. And just kind of putting two and two together for me, is from my position I am now, I think that a lot of those spiritual experiences happened from this back then. And it was common in those days to think that you got closer to God through these hallucinogenic, you know, as we know about like Native Americans and Peyote. It's tradition for so many things. You feel closer to God, you have all those experiences. And I think my view is that Joseph tried to get closer to God, and when he went to the Sacred Grove, that's what he experienced. It dries your mouth out, makes it hard to speak when you first take it. It makes you kind of black out and feel sick for a little while. Then you get over that, then you have the blinding white light experience. And when you hear people talk about taking these, it's like bam, bam, bam. It parallels very perfectly, and super interesting. All right. Cool. We're going well. Negative emotions. I'm going to kind of go through this pretty quick so I can get to tribalism more. Feelings opposite the spirit. We're kind of told, and I talked about this a little before, as we feel these uncomfortable emotions, it's from Satan. It's never just from our intuition and actually telling us that something's bad. You know, we see my wife in Baltimore. She got in this elevator all by herself. It was the back service elevator. And this dude looked at her and stepped into the elevator and freaked her out. Every fiber of her being was telling her this guy's a bad dude and get out of it. I don't think that was necessarily the spirit. I think that was our body. We see alone in an elevator with this guy who's really freaky, he's looking at you in very sexual ways. You don't need much to tell you that's not a good situation to be in. Guilt and fear. These are emotions that we evolve because they can motivate us powerfully to be better, to do good things, to help others. All these things, they come together. The fear I'm going to talk a lot about in tribalism. And contention, which is it irritates me that you can't talk about difficult subjects because always contention is of the devil, and you can't differentiate between contention and difficult subjects because we can really grow and learn if we can talk about difficult things and move on. All right, tribalism. Okay, so this tribalism, the loyalty to your group, where you prejudice other groups over your group as being bad, prejudice your group as being good over others. There's a few manifestations of tribalism that I'm going to use to kind of make sense of this kind of more complex thing. They are how we prejudice other tribes is bad, prejudice our tribe is good. You have fear of leaving the tribe, bullying those that have left the tribe, pains that come from being rejected by your tribe, and then tribal identifiers. I'm going to talk about each of these as I've done before the format where I talk about how it evolved, how it is in non-Mormons and Mormons. I'm going to talk about each of these things in there, so there'll be subsets of that. So first off, I'm going to combine how it evolved and examples of it in Mormons today. Basically, tribalism is ultra-sociality. It actually exists in a lot of insects and there's like five species that have done this. The one interesting thing, like compared to bees and stuff, is that I didn't read anything that stuck out to me. I think we're the only ultra-sociality group where we get to kind of pick our status and move around. We aren't born into a worker bee where our genes make us a worker bee, but that's all we want to do. We have more flexibility, more plasticity in that way, which is kind of amazing. I'm very happy about that. Okay, prejudice is other tribes. This is conflicting. I'm going to skip this over. The research I did, it seems like in our pre-agricultural society, we actually weren't that tribal and hating other tribes. There's a lot of intermixing going on sexually and stuff like that. It kind of is a result of our agricultural society and having possession. This is my farm, putting up fences, all that type of stuff. So I'm going to skip that since that's a little more controversial. Prejudicing your tribe is good. Stanford study, this is kind of funny. So there were some sociologists, social theorists at Stanford that conducted a study where they had two groups of students and they put them into these two clubs, they just randomly assigned, and made one club easy to get into but fun, one group really hard to get into, and all they do is sit around, it was kind of boring. And then they had them just go on, see how long they'd stay in the club. The club that was easy to get into, but fun, didn't last as long. The club that was really hard to get into, and they had the pride of having this hard club to get into, even though it sucked to be in, they didn't do anything enjoyable. They didn't get the free pizza, which college students love, they were given to the other group. They stayed in that, and it lasted a lot longer. It kept going. So the harder your group is to get into, the more difficult it is to leave. And it doesn't make sense. I don't know why that is, actually. Get a good explanation of that, but that's the studies show that. And we see that Mormonism. Mormonism has a lot of restrictions that we have and stuff like that that makes it hard to be a part of. But ironically, the churches that have the least amount of requirements are the ones that have the hardest time keeping their members today, and the ones that are the more strict and rigid are keeping them. It just pulls us in. Fear of leaving the tribe. This is pretty powerful, and I'm going to speak about this personally later, but if you... pre-modern humans that weren't afraid to go off and be on their own were more likely to get eaten by the saber-toothed tiger, stomped on by the woolly mammoth, and the ones that wanted to combine together and go kill the woolly mammoth together and help each other out and have good feelings from helping each other out were more likely to do that, have all that meat and survive. So we have in us really powerful fear emotions that are elicited when we think of leaving the tribe. And anyone who's had a faith, crisis of faith, where your family members, your spouse is still traditionally believing and you want to step away, those are some pretty scary feelings you feel with the thinking of what could happen, how that rejection could occur. Bullying those that left. This is a shaming technique, and it used to have some positive results, like Chelsea talking about how if you don't have any painkillers, you can use shaming to help people control their pain and function in a higher thing. So it could, used to have some good effects. I feel like in modern society, this is one thing that we need to move beyond, the shaming, and we don't need that tool necessarily any longer, but it can have some pretty powerful effects on us. And then the pain of being rejected. The worst thing that you can do is be a traitor. There's a link to this article in the long paper, but there were some ultra-Orthodox Jews that had some priests that were sexually abusing their children. And there were a couple people that were whistleblowers that let that information get out. And the tribe, the congregation, was harsh and really mad at the whistleblower. Instead of being mad at the rabbi that was convicting the doing the sexual molestation of the little kids, they were harsher to the whistleblower. It's worse to be a traitor than anything else. Worse to be a traitor in that tribe than it was to be the sexual abuser. And it seems unbelievable, but it happens. And so if you've been the traitor and you feel that social rejection, it's pretty powerful and it affects you strongly. All right, and identifiers. We see this all the time in the modern world of a sports team. Everyone's wearing the sports logos and feeling the happiness that comes from feeling a part of that tribe and that community. All right, so examples in Mormonism of these things. And we're doing all right, cool. So I'm going to run through these fast. We try and create Zion. We avoid leaving. That's our aspects of tribalism. We prejudice others as bad. We don't drink coffee. All those people that drink coffee, they're so terrible because they drink this drink that actually helps you live longer and it's good for your health. But they're bad people because they do this terrible thing of drinking coffee. We don't, so we're awesome. You know, we don't do that thing. We're all amazing. That meme of Jesus hugging the guy, have you seen that online? I'm so glad you didn't drink coffee. Seriously. Fear of leaving the tribe. That's, to me, getting excommunicated was actually vindicating for me. And when I got excommunicated for sharing my doubts, which I shared to try and help other people who were suffering, so I felt like I was being Christ-like. And I asked myself, what would Jesus do? Even though I don't really believe in the Jesus that you get in Mormonism, I like that idea and I keep that in my life. By trying to help others and be Christ-like, the church that I felt like was not Christ's church rejected me for being Christ-like, and that was a very big stamp of approval for me. So that felt good to get, and I carried it as a badge of honor, actually. And as Lindsay actually Hanson Park said, if you've been excommunicated, you're actually more Mormon, because that's kind of what Mormons do. So I'm more Mormon than all of you that haven't been excommunicated. It'll come to me in a bit. The traumatic, that's what it was. Leaving, getting excommunicated wasn't that bad. Feeling the rejection from the tribe has been worse than I thought it would be. And not so much because it has been so overwhelmingly overpowering, as it just drags on. And even though I know I made a good decision, I feel very good about my decision. Every time I'm around my parents, every time I'm around my friends that are Mormons, I'm feeling that social rejection, and it hurts, even though I don't want to, even though I'm like, you guys are stupid, or can you see this, or I don't like you guys anyway, you've been so mean to me. It still hurts. You can't get over it, and that's because we evolved to have those strong feelings to keep us in the tribe, and they're powerful. It kind of sucks, but that's the way it is. So trying to develop a better sense of self and not have that affect me as much, but it is strong. And I'm going to skip that, identifiers. We have a lot of identifiers, and I think we all kind of know that. That helps us know who is Mormon and who is not. Okay, problem with Mormon position. The same difficulties exist in other religions. People will tell you all these bad things, feelings you're having, Carson, when you left, is because God's telling you you've lost a spirit, you need to go back to the Mormon church. Problem is, Jehovah's Witnesses feel that exact same thing. I've talked to them about the church. Even people from very... I don't want to use a cultish word, but the more cultish the religion can be, the higher the demand it can be, the harder that is, the more you feel those feelings. So unless God wants us all to stay in whatever religion we grew up in, it's not telling you to go back to the Mormon church, unless he doesn't care what church you're in, as long as you stay in the church, and he's making us all feel that in whatever religion we're in. Awesome thing about social media in today is it's making a difference. Coming to Sunstone last year, my was powerful for my wife. She was on the fence. She was actually kind of scared to come because all those bad people, those evil ex-Mormons. But she came and saw all these awesome people. And we went to a few parties and saw these amazing people that were just so kind and good. And it was like, holy cow, there's actually, ex-Mormons are good people. And it made it so that she could feel better about herself and move on. I think we're hitting a critical mass. Everybody pretty much knows someone who's left the church now. And a lot of them are good people. They don't fit the stereotype they may have had. And that gives them confidence. One, it pressures them to rethink the conclusions they had previously, but it makes it feel more comfortable to move on. To even if you stay in Mormonism, which can be awesome, and you can help try and make change, make a bigger tent, all that, if you can feel more comfortable being that vocal voice because you know other good people are doing the same thing, and social media is helping that critical mass get hit and be aware of others. All right, confirmation bias. I'm going to go through this quick as well. What I'm going to probably do here is actually read this. All right, so just some, go Google confirmation biases and look into them all, and you can see how they play so powerful into us. One, and you see it, Mormons, anybody having a belief, and you can give them logic, you can give them scientific evidence, and they'll reject it, or bad things happen. The blind spot, bias blind spot. You see yourself as less biased than others. We all do that. Choice supportive bias. You remember your choices is better than they really were. Anchoring. You rely too heavily or anchor on one trait or piece of information. You had this one experience where you felt the spirit this one time. Even though you hear, you'll have a million things that show you the church may not be true, you can't let go of that one because you anchor on that so powerfully. Especially if it felt more real than real, like we talked about. Empathy gap. Underestimate the power of feeling and making your decisions, thinking it was more based in facts than emotion when it was actually the other way around. Irrational escalation, justifying increased investment because you are already invested, despite more evidence suggesting that investment is bad. Always best, one of her friends did that, walked up to that cliff, saw how scary it would be to leave, and went back while she watched basically my wife tumble down and go through all the torture that process can happen. It can be scary to walk away, and it's almost easier, it feels emotionally easier to stay even if we think it's a bad decision than to move on and let go. All right. Cognitive dissonance, we all probably heard about that. I'm gonna skip over how it evolved. That gets a little complex, but basically, allowed us to stick to our plans and go forward with it. I'm going to get to my conclusions here real quick. There's a bunch of studies where they had people get in line to bet on horses. They would ask randomly before they put their bets down how confident they were in their horse would win. And then they'd ask random people after they put their bet, the people significantly, if they put their bet down, their confidence shot up versus 2 seconds before when they hadn't put their money in. You make that decision, and it's a good decision. It's the right one, even if it's not. It feels that way too. If we do something more and more and more, it feels right to us, even if we get information that it's not. The more we get our testimony over and over again, let's say we record it and play it back to ourselves over and over again, and then it'll make us think it's right. You can't reason a person out of a position they didn't reason themselves into. And as someone mentioned earlier, the Jonathan Haidt work, how a lot of times we come to our conclusions emotionally and we use logic to back them up, and we all do it, and it makes it so that no matter how much logic you give them, it's not going to take you out of that. So let me skip forward to conclusions. This is my favorite, the tender mercy example. Since I left the church, I've had things that have happened that made it so it looked like God was telling me this is what I need to do, or this is a good decision, and I love dropping the tender mercy bomb every time that happens. Something I can't think of examples now, but I say that actually because as you're a traitor, people are going to be looking for you to fail. If you lose your job, it's because you left the church. If you lose your job while you're in the church, it's because you need a lesson to grow. Anything bad that happens, they're going to say it was a result of your decision. So anytime anything good happens, I broke my foot, healed up super fast. Like I was doing squats. I like to powerlift a lot, and I was doing squats within a couple weeks of having this broken bone in my foot. And so I put that on Facebook and wrote tender mercies, and I got zero likes from my friends and family that are there in the church. They didn't think that was too funny. But I like it. I love doing that because it makes them think. It makes them break out of that box that they're in and look at things legitimately, because they are looking for you to fail, to justify their position. So we just need to use the scientific method in our lives more. Another interesting study they did was where they, actually several times this happened, where they've followed people in hospitals that pray to get better and those that don't. And the results always come back, you know, bell curve, always 50. You, the people who prayed healed. Well, I need to clarify this. Overall, the people who prayed healed equally with those who didn't. If you do certain rituals, you can improve your body's response to healing, stuff like that. So I'm not getting into that part of it. Just the overall having miracles happen in your life. The miracles happen the same ratio for those who pray and those who don't, if that makes sense. All right. I'm going to skip these, actually. If you want to read this, like I said, I'll have the link at the end. The Emperor's New Clothes, it's crazy. It happens so much. It's changing because of social media. Let's get through. Emotional connection. I want to say this is really irritating when people say disciplinary counselors are where they feel the spirit of the strongest. To me, it's they don't have significant, like my dad. He just doesn't have a lot of significant emotional connections with people. So if he goes in and someone opens up and is authentic and tells their story and confesses all their sin, bam, they have a strong emotional connection with that person. It happened in ours, and it made, I even said it, like, you guys are all feeling the spirit strongly. Tell you that what we're doing is good, and we need to make this keep happening. We need to keep being more open and talking about the truth. But they still, in the end, even though it was so heartbreaking, they couldn't go with what they felt, and they went with the pressure they felt from the handbook. Got the gaps, ratchet effect. If you haven't heard of those, look those up. It's happening. And conclusion. All right, I'll do this so I can finish here on time. So, what does this mean for the church? You know, the more science we get, actually, sorry, let's skip this. I do want to throw a shout out to religion. It has been a big positive for us as we've evolved. Religion has brought us together. It's given us motivation. It's strengthened us. And it's, and there's so many wonderful things that have come from religion. But it's at a time where I feel like we need to take the good of religion, drop the bad, and move on to a better place. Where we can have that community, we can support each other, we don't have to be so closed-minded, dogmatic, anti-science. If we could take the best of all that and put it together, that would be amazing. So let's all combine to help make that happen. So what does this mean for the church? Work with more logical conclusions and stop fighting that. They can't control the message of today's world. It's like they're painting themselves into a corner a little bit, or a lot of it. I feel like there's three hurdles that I've noticed, and this is not really for the church, I guess. I put this in there because I thought of it here. As I see people step away from the church, it seems like it happens in three, for most people, not always, but three phases. First, some will happen. They'll have a gay child, or they'll find out that Joseph Smith married a 14-year-old girl when he's 35 and lied to his wife about it and didn't even use the rules that are in Doctrine Covenants 132 to do it. And they're like, and they know it's on the church's webpage now, and they're like, what? And it shocks them. Their first step will be they'll realize the doctrine and the brethren are perfect, and that will kind of crack that testimony. And then, but they'll say, I want to stay in the church because I've had these spiritual experiences that tell me that this is God's church, but it's just imperfect people. And then they'll eventually kind of reframe those spiritual experiences, kind of like what we've gone through today. I'm like, well, I don't believe that was God giving me a testimony that this is the true church, but this community, I want to stay a part of it. And eventually, unfortunately, the part that I'm bothered the most with is that becomes too toxic. That's what happened to me. My wife told me, stop going to Sunday school, Carson. You get pissed off the rest of the day. Just go to McDonald's and get a drink. And so I'd go and then come back for Elders' Corner and have an awesome time. I love my Elders' Corner. It was good. If we could make it so that it wasn't so toxic, we could keep all those people. I would have stayed. I'd be an active, fully engaged in my Elders' Corner presidency today if it wasn't for ordained women and making me lose my testimony. Or my testimony, Temple Recommend, the other T word. Thank you. This isn't enough for you guys, but like, if anyone wants to throw a rebuttal to this, the rebuttal I'd ask for is, why do everyone in other religions feel these same things? If they leave, why do they feel the same things? Don't pick apart anything else, just focus on that. If anyone wants to go against what I said, please rebut that before anything else. What does this mean for you? If you leave, keep all that good of Mormonism and the good of religion and help other people, be Christ-like, reach out to those, be empathetic and loving, drop the bad. Don't justify 35-year-old men marrying 14-year-old girls behind their wives' back. You can drop that, move on, keep the good, and it's a lot better place. Be happy by focusing on the documentary Happy. Amazing. Watch it. It's on Netflix. Or at least it used to be in heaven. Three things that bring us happiness: social connections, service, and personal growth. We focus on those things. If I read a Brené Brown book for a half hour, I get more out of it that makes my life better than I did out of a month of reading the scriptures over and over again that I've already read 50 times. It's so nice to be able to do that. Build those social connections, do service, and help yourself grow. Be nice to yourself and others. It's a long, hard process. Don't push people to get out of the church too much, because it's traumatic. I don't even actually like to necessarily encourage people to get out. I like to just give them information, let them decide, but not push them. Be nice to yourself. It's hard. It's a long process. So that is it. If you would like, we'll have a couple minutes for questions, I believe, right? Just a couple? So maybe a couple. And if you have, feel free to email me, evolutionhijack@calder.org. That's not my real email, obviously, but that'll work. It'll get to me. And if you want the 20-page version with all the sources after the 20 pages, you can go to this, carsonstuff.noteasybutworthit.org. Just two things. I'm kind of trying to make a website where I can put things that will help people transition with more happiness and less pain. And also, if you guys haven't heard about it, the mormonspectrum.org webpage that I've been helping out with, it's just to bring people together. We need to build that community. If you live in Indiana and don't know any other ex-Mormons, go on there, click on the map, look what transitioning, post, whatever, hiking groups with kids, Mormon groups are on there, and build that community. And that's it. Thank you. Any quick questions for the last minute or two we have?
So, I've read The Righteous Mind by John Pate, and he talks about how when someone posts something politically on Facebook, or, you know, like has a stance on something, there's that intuitive evolutionary reason why they feel the way they feel. And he talks about how you should, like, notice that, you know, if someone's posting about, they're either, like, loyal, or they value sanctity. Some people think that purity is, like, being authentic, and other people think purity is keeping your spirit clean from bad things. So it's different for different people. And it's just like if someone likes Mexican food versus sushi. It's just innately evolutionary who they are. My problem is, when you recognize that intuition, what is your suggestion for speaking to people who are religious? Because in my book, in my experience, you can say, like, okay, I understand why, like, you're so focused on, like, the Planned Parenthood video, and, like, you know, that's, like, you're so obsessed with, like, abortion and not all the good things that Planned Parenthood does. Using logic, like, doesn't work, because they can always trump you with, well, because God says that it's wrong. So my question is, how do you talk to people using this, you know, evolutionary knowledge and trying to get on their level and relate to, like, this is why they feel the way, this is why they believe this way, it's this evolutionary trait, knowing that information, how do you come at them with, like, a calm, rational discussion to maybe have them see your point of view as well?
Without triggering them. I think, I'm no expert on this, but it seems like even John, I think he might say in his book, in that book, or one of the TED Talks he gave, about how basically we have similarities. There's those differences, we have the similarities. We care about helping people. So if we can focus on that part of it, that can help out. But at the same hand, trying to use that to then help them see your side just doesn't work. And honestly, I don't know. We talk about it all the time. But is there anything we could do that would help it so that people, without having to have a gay child or have some traumatic experience that could trigger that understanding to bridge that gap? I don't know. I just think we can be empathetic, build those relationships. The more they understand us, it seems like the more they're willing to do it. So just love them and support them. And then I think as they understand you, they'll be more good. All right, so email if you have the questions. I think that's it. Time. Thank you, guys.